Okay, where to start? As you know, just to start from the beginning, we just returned from several weeks in the Middle East. We took a tour, about 142 people, to Israel. We'll be doing this each spring, so if you missed this time, pray about next spring. We'll be announcing dates in the newsletter shortly. This particular tour included 3 days in Jerusalem to attend the International Temple Conference. And I'll give you a little report on that. But then also, after the tour of Israel, we went to Egypt. And I wanted to share some reactions to Egypt tonight with you, specifically. But first of all, I should mention that I'd like to get some T-shirts made that say, "I skied where Jesus walked." I'm exaggerating only a little bit. We had over 1,000 millimeters of precipitation in Jerusalem the year to date. And, of course, while we were there, they had snowfall. A couple of feet of it, by the way. And it was wild. Jerusalem, of course, is totally incapable of dealing with that. It's the first time since 1846 that they've been taking data that they had it, this much. They've had occasional light snows, but this was a real snow. And so, it's one of those things, though, the Lord really used. It encumbered us not a bit. We had the first 3 days of our tour, we had planned to be in the Jerusalem Hilton anyway for the conference. And so the only problem that the snow created was to make sure we could get our speakers there. We were able to accelerate several of them to fill in the times that we had planned to be away and tour. And so we really just had an intensive 3 days of delightful times. I'll summarize for you. And then about the time we were ready to go, the snow cleared. And so we had a wonderful time touring Jerusalem. We saw the Temple Mount under snow. That's kind of different. We had everybody took pictures, had historic pictures. It was kind of fun. And so we did all the usual things. After seeing Jerusalem, the Temple Mount and the Garden Tomb and all that sort of thing, we, of course, in the meantime, we also took on Shabbat, because everything shuts down, we went down the Jericho Road and then south through Qumran and Ein Gedi and, of course, Masada. And of course, I'm one of these guys that just loves to, you can take the tram up and down. That's a sensible thing to do. I like to climb it. It's only an hour, hour and a quarter, maybe at the most. But I learned something interesting archaeologically about Masada this trip. In the last 8 years, it's gotten higher, Yeah. So, anyway, and of course, we toured Israel, we had a chance to go up. You're in for a real surprise if you get to Beit Shan, because those of you that visited Israel maybe some years ago, Beit Shan is an archaeological dig. There's a tell there, but they've discovered not at the tell, but next to the tell, they have uncovered a huge Roman town, and it's probably larger than any ruins even in Italy. There's something like an 8,000 person Colosseum that you can actually use in effect, and the Roman baths. It goes on for just acres and acres and acres. It's incredible and just incredible, beautiful job they're doing. And then we went up, of course, to Galilee. Because of the snow and the precipitation, there was so much water that the baptismal area, if you're familiar with it, was so ravaged with currents that we couldn't baptize there. So we baptized right in the Sea of Galilee. That was kind of fun. And if you like getting baptized in melted snow, of course, at Big Bear, we're used to that. So had a wonderful time there, of course, doing all the usual things, taking a boat across and so on. And we had all the usual things. We went to Megiddo. We had Jeremiah Films on there on camera, and we did a sort of a special study of Megiddo, Armageddon, at the site. So that was kind of fun. And Caesarea, and then about a third of our tour went home from there, about two-thirds of our tour, some 80-some-odd, went on to Egypt. And we'll talk a little bit about that. I might mention just a few things about the Temple Conference. It was kind of fun because it happened. We arrived there Monday night, and normally the first night we just leave free because everybody's jet-lagged or been a long flight, and they want to crash. But it happened that there's a friend of mine that lives in Jerusalem by the name of Jerry Schroeder. Dr. Gerald L. Schroeder is famous for having written a book called Genesis and the Big Bang. He's not only an Orthodox Jew, has tremendous insight in the book of Genesis by virtue of being very familiar with some of the ancient Hebrew commentators, but also he's a world-class nuclear physicist, having participated in six atomic bomb blasts. I called Jerry just socially. It turned out he's free that night, so he popped over to the hotel, and we had an optional evening that I guess I'd say well over half of our tour decided to sit in. And Jerry was a lot of fun because he shared in great enthusiasm and so forth, but to a lay audience, a lot of things, especially about the age of the universe. And it was kind of fun. He took us through, and among other things, he took us through Einstein's general theory, which is a wonderful conversation after being on a plane 30 hours, whatever. No, seriously. He pointed out that time dilates in accordance with mass, so he took the mass of the Earth and the mass of the universe, plugged it into the equations, and pointed out that the 15 billion years we observe in the universe equate to, guess how much on the face of the Earth? 6 days, you got it, right. Isn't that wild? Yeah. And he'll be publishing that shortly, and we'll get it in our newsletter so you can follow the equations. They're actually not that complicated, so you can watch for that in our newsletter. If you're not a subscriber in our newsletter, shame on you. It's only $20 a year, but to this group it's free. So just give me your name and address or give it to Richard Brooks, that's the rabbi with the yarmulke in the back, when you leave, and you'll be make sure you're on our mailing list. In any case, Jerry came over that night. We had a wonderful time. In the subsequent days, I won't summarize the whole conference right now, but I'd like to mention a few things. Rabbi Chaim Richman of the Temple Institute came over. And the best way I could characterize this fun young rabbi is I regard him as the Woody Allen of Jerusalem. He has a very wry sense of humor, but he did with great sincerity and a lot of good, clever wit, communicated to us the perspective that Judaism has, especially the temple and the coming Messiah in their view and the rest. And that was very illuminating and a lot of fun. And we became very close friends. In fact, we saw each other socially on some other things subsequently. We also, of course, had Dr. Asher Kaufman spend an evening with us. And Asher, if you've met him, is a dear, dear friend. His latest book, of course, is published in Hebrew, but it has only one page in English, which is a dedication to a pastor, Chuck Smith, you probably have heard of, and myself, who financed some of his early work. So Asher's an old friend and a delightful human being, and he took us through the basis for his rather controversial conjecture that the temple stood north of the Dome of the Rock. We also had presentations during the conference of reasons that are increasingly stirring up some interest that the temple stood to the south of the Dome of the Rock for a number of reasons, and we'll review all that next Wednesday in detail. But also we had Dan Bahat speak to us. Dan Bahat is the chief archaeologist of the Jerusalem district, and he, in great articulate form, explained why the archaeologists and the rabbis generally regard the Dome of the Rock as the site without any question, and he took us through all of that. And again, we'll go through all that next Wednesday for those with charts and diagrams and stuff when we're organized to do that. Perhaps the thing that stole the show, if you will, was the evening we had Gershon Salmon speak to us. Now, you probably have heard that name in the news because he's the leader of an activist group known as the Temple Mount Faithful. And it's kind of interesting, as one of the sponsors of all of this, to be having a speaker that has been announced by the Jerusalem Post as the guy that is the number one man on the PLO hit list. And so he's a delightful guy. I did breathe a sigh of relief when I saw him disappear into the night later. But here's a guy that came over. He was a paratrooper during the Six-Day War, and he still has a limp from some injuries and things. But he came and he planned to spend an hour just sharing the views as to why the temple's important and what's going on in Israel from an Orthodox Jewish point of view, a very active, aggressive guy, a guy that'll probably be in the Knesset before long. Very, very articulate, fun guy. But what was interesting, planned to spend an hour, and we held him for at least four. And before it was over, there were tears in the eyes of the audience and of Gershon Salmon as we got to know one another. Because don't misunderstand, he's an Orthodox Jew. He's not a Christian, but he was it was fascinating to see his reaction as he discovered that we regard our Messiah, a son of David as our Messiah. He didn't understand that. And I kidded him. I said, there's really very little difference between us. When the Messiah comes, we'll simply ask him whether it's his first or second visit, you see. In conferring with Gershon Salmon that I'm considering organizing a little project. I've thought about organizing it's intriguing to me how our administration gives tens of billions of dollars to our Arab partners without interfering with their domestic politics. And yet we won't guarantee loans to Israel unless they declare part of Israel off limits to Jews. Does that sound a little hypocritical? So it occurred to me that wouldn't it be fun if a group of American Christians could organize some funds, not as a donation or anything like that, but as a loan bank, and loan money on a first mortgage basis guaranteed by the Israeli government to let them build apartments for these Russians that are arriving and let them build them wherever they like. Now, I've raised a lot of money on Wall Street for corporate projects. I frankly have not raised money for mortgage kinds of things, but it's my instinct that it wouldn't take a lot of money to make a statement. And secondly, I think the Democrats might lean over backwards, do anything to embarrass Bush. So it's a thought, and I'm not being modest here. I just really don't have a lot of experience on raising this kind of money, but I think it'd be interesting because we're not talking donations. We're talking loan money. First mortgage kind of things. And I also suspect if we had it right, the Israeli government would step up and guarantee it. But in any case, it wouldn't take a lot to really make a statement that Israel would really hear. I think it would be very, very provocative. So is it a good idea? I don't know. I haven't prayed about it enough. But I mentioned it so you might pray about it and give me your thoughts, you know, what have you. And it's something that you can spend a lot of time on these projects. I'm not anxious to get to build a nightmare thing here. But on the other hand, I thought it might be a worthy move, and to do it in the name of Christ, in the name of Yeshua HaMashiach, on behalf of the Russian immigrants that are pouring into Israel. And what an interesting thing to do! It's humanitarian, but it also might make a statement that we support Israel, quite independent of the charged emotional terms called West Bank and what have you. Somebody asked you about the West Bank. Ask them which river. Okay. Do you know that Jordan's the only river in the world with only one bank? Did you know that? Anyway, learned one interesting thing. We were at Masada watching the Israeli jets, shoot up the Jordan Valley, and it occurred to me that the Israeli Air Force is the only Air Force in the world that flies below sea level. Anyway, enough of that. There's much we can talk about the Temple Conference, but I think I'll leave that for when we focus specifically on a whole update on the Temple. I really like to head somewhere else tonight a little bit. If I may. We had another guest on the tour that was also a speaker at the conference, a guy by the name of Lambert Dolphin. He's an old friend of ours, known him for, 20 years? Very well-known technologist. He used to be head of the radiophysics lab at SRI, Stanford Research Institute. He's the one that facilitated the introduction of ground-penetrating radar and other techniques to Israel about 10 years ago. In fact, it was our involvement with Lambert that caused Don Stewart and I to undertake the book that you, I'm sure, have heard of The Coming Temple, which is now in its second printing and chugging along. Lambert was also a consultant to the Egyptian government on the Great Pyramid, again, attempting to use some of these techniques on the Great Pyramid. It turns out, of course, interestingly enough, that the conditions in Egypt are too moist. That is, the rocks, surprisingly enough, you'd think in the desert it wouldn't be true, but the rocks are, limestone's too moist to lend itself to the radar-type techniques. In Israel, it's quite the contrary. It works out very well. But the point is, Lambert, who lives in Santa Clara, was on the tour and led many of the studies, an expert technologist, and he and I will be doing probably at least one book together on the speed of light slowing down and some of that stuff, and with Barry Setterfield in Australia. And Lambert was also there, and we had some wonderful, it was very appropriate because he's been very, on a first-hand basis, involved with all these experts on the temple and also he was one of our escorts when we went to Egypt, which I'll come to in a minute. In fact, what I'd like to do tonight a little bit is shift gears. I've commented on on Israel. Let me just summarize Israel before we leave Israel and go to Egypt. If you've visited Israel, you'll know what I'm talking about when I say the minute you arrive, when that plane lands, you have a strange feeling. You have a feeling you're home. It's a strange experience because as you mix with the people, it's not that they're particularly lovable. I mean, you find all shapes and sizes. Some you can really relate to. They're warm, wonderful people. Others are the kind that you generally experience in a bargain basement, elbow out, you know. They're all kinds, and there are some that annoy you, some that'll push and shove and what have you. And what I'm trying to say is I'm not glamorizing the population particularly, although obviously many of them are very, very wonderful people. That's not my point. But when you're in Israel, it's a strange thing. You really feel that you are someplace special. It's always fascinated me that the God of the universe would separate out a parcel of ground and call it his own. You know, you'd say, well, gee, all the earth is holy. It's his creation. No, there's something very special about Israel in the scripture, but also you experience it when you're there. You experience it when you fly over it because you see desert everywhere except where the boundaries of Israel are, and within those boundaries it's green and it's cultivated and it's yielding fruit. You've got a country here that's one-third the size of San Bernardino County, that's the fourth largest exporter of fruit in the world. So there's something going on. But and of course, for lots of reasons, Israel is home. When you're in Israel, everything suddenly comes alive. All the Bible passages you've read, all the Bible stories you've heard or learned as a kid, suddenly are vivid, alive, tangible. In fact, having been there, there's probably not a passage of Scripture that rings quite the same. It's all a little more real, a little more vital, a little more tangible, a little more in hand when you're in Israel. So if you've been there, you know what I'm talking about. If you haven't been there, I do suggest that you prayerfully consider somewhere along the way, when God's timing is right, to plan a visit with Chuck, myself, Hal Lindsey, or whoever happens to be the situation that God puts in front of you at the time. But think about it, pray about it. It's something that I really do encourage you. Chuck Smith is quoted as having made the remark that a visit to Israel is better than a year in seminary. Now, I suspect that might be more commentary on seminary than it is Israel, but I won't get to that right now. Now, I should share with you, I've been to Israel many, many times, half a dozen tours, but also probably more than that in terms of visits for business or other reasons. I had never been to Egypt. I've been to North Africa a great deal in my consulting background, and I won't bore you with those anecdotes. The point is I've been well-traveled, but I have not been to Egypt. I've always wanted to go to Egypt, not only for its own sake, but also specifically for the Great Pyramid, because, as you know, I've been intrigued with that, studied it for years, and I'm always appalled when I discover some author who's pontificating on the Great Pyramid, and I discover he's never visited it, and I always feel a certain letdown. I thought, I don't want to be guilty of that. I want to go there, and there's several things I want to check out, which I did. In fact, I was, much to my glee, I was able to get in the Great Pyramid and snoop around a little bit and came to a few conclusions, but that's not my purpose tonight. The point I wanted to make was I had not been to Egypt before, so I was, in effect, even though I was the tour leader, I was a sort of a tag-along as far as a learning experience is concerned. I had done my homework. I'd done a lot of reading, and that, I think, helped, but did not prepare me for what I encountered. And I think it'd be meaningful, but my real plan tonight is to chat a little bit about Egypt. Now, when you get to Cairo, the first thing you find, of course, is a very large metropolitan city. It's not at all primitive in the classical sense. It's a very substantial city, 14 million population. So you're looking at a high-rise, big, modern city. It does have the stamp of Islam on it. It has the stamp of North Africa on it, if you know what I'm talking about. It's certainly in the Middle East. You feel it everywhere, but it is still a nice, modern city. Near our hotel, fortunately, there is a place that in itself is a legend, the Cairo Museum. The first thing we did, of course, in our tour plans was to get thoroughly briefed on much, not all, but much of what that museum offered. It sounds corny to go to a local museum. Let me tell you, if you're in Cairo, one of the first things you do want to do is visit the Cairo Museum and with an expert. Over 100,000 objects there, and it will take you through their history. And we got well briefed on the dynasties, on the Old Kingdom, the Middle Kingdom, the New Kingdom. We had a chance to see firsthand, not just the mummies, but all the other accoutrements to their cultural and religious practices. Now, bear in mind, we're talking about a culture that ruled the world. The two oldest cultures on the planet Earth are the Sumerian culture in Mesopotamia and the Egyptian culture. And various experts argue about which one might be technically slightly older than the other, but they both go back to nominally about 3000 BC. So you're talking about ancient roots as far as, you know, anthropology is concerned, as far as cultures are concerned. Egypt, with all its mysteries and with all its colorful background, let's first of all recognize it ruled the world. It was the first great empire, long before Assyria. After Egypt came Assyria, and after Assyria, Babylon, after Babylon, Persia, then the Greeks, then the Romans, and most of us are more familiar with those empires than we are perhaps with the intricacies and background of ancient Egypt. We also, in addition to the Cairo Museum, just to give you a quick profile, we also, of course, being in Cairo, which is right essentially a suburb of it, is Giza, where the Great Pyramid is. There are actually three large pyramids there. But the Great Pyramid, for a variety of reasons I won't bother going into tonight, has this particular fascination. We went out to Saqqara. We saw the Step Pyramid, and on and on and on. We did spend one day, for those that wanted to pop up to Luxor and Karnak. That's, 400 miles up the Nile. And that is spectacular, worth seeing, even more of the same, huge, incredible monuments, palaces, and so forth. It's interesting that while we were in Israel, as you could probably predict, I was constantly shooting my mouth off. My business card says, have Bible, will babble. And while in Israel, I think in general, I lived up to that appellation because there's so much to talk about and there's so many implications of everything you run into. It's exciting and fun and so forth. I probably wearied some of the tour to death on some of that, others in other cases, I think. Anyway, when we got to Egypt, about halfway through the tour, several of my closer friends among the tour came to me and says, Chuck, what's wrong? You're so quiet. And I made some silly remark to shrug it off. But what was going on was not clear to me then, but became clearer as the trip unfolded. And I wanted to share some of the observations with you for reasons that will become obvious. As we went through the Cairo Museum and saw the dynasties and the tombs and the implements and all of that, as we went through the pyramids and all of that, we were getting a thorough briefing on site of the gods they worshipped. It's interesting to study the Egyptian culture, especially as it is a polytheistic culture. It worships. It's something interesting about polytheism is that the gods always multiply. Once you've got a few, you get a lot more. They start making gods of everything. As you study the Egyptian mysticism, you, of course, discover that they venerated the animals, all kinds. In Asia, of course, we're all familiar with, you know, the idea of the cattle being holy. Well, Egypt carries that all the way around. The calf worship in Egypt is not a surprise to us. We've read Exodus. We know all about that. Don't know the half of it. Well, I guess we do. If you think about Exodus, you've got the lice and the frogs and the flies and so forth, right? It's interesting as you study the Egyptian religious environment, and you recognize that this wasn't a little phase they went through. This endured for thousands of years. As you go through all the different gods they worshipped, do you know what's at the top of the heap? Have you ever seen a scarab as a piece of jewelry? They're the little beetle. By the way, they're not very little. They're big there. How many of you knew that the top of the thing is the scarab beetle? Is that familiar to you? I'm just curious. Give me a show of hands. I didn't see if, okay. As we got into that, and I made it my business to try to learn a little bit about this as we go for a lot of reasons, I was rather startled to discover what the scarab beetle really is. You know what it is? It's a dung beetle. Really. It turns out, as you get behind the mysticism of, into the mysticism of how the Egyptians look at these things, when, and I don't know how to say this delicately, so just forgive me. When there are animal feces on the side of the, or any feces for that matter, on the side of the road, very shortly thereafter, the dung beetle shows up from nowhere. The Egyptians imagined it, or perceived it, as coming out of nothing. So from this kind of logic, they attributed to the dung beetle the concept of creation. You see, you have to understand, and it sounds a little unfair to say it so glibly, but that's sort of the mystical alphabet they're dealing with. When the dung beetle was observed rolling a turd, frankly, across the road. No, bear with me. Bear with them. No. Don't make this harder than it is. They saw an analogy between that and the God of the universe moving the sun from east to west. Now, bear in mind, the Nile goes north and south, from south to north, obviously. So their whole world is east and west. East is birth, west is death. They built whole cities for the dead. The city of the dead is always on the west bank. See, that's when the sun goes down. They live on the east bank. You follow me? There's all of that symbolism. And the concept of the sun rising and setting was very much tied to all their different mystical ascriptions. But the point I'm getting at is, of course, as you get into this and if you start studying this, you discover the peculiar, unique, pivotal role of this that they ascribed to the dung beetle. Now, as I got into this, and as you spend several days seeing all of this firsthand and experiencing the history of this once great empire, I couldn't shake the obvious conclusion of their preoccupation with death. You see, when you start studying the pharaohs, you discover the tomb wasn't something they ended their life with. It's something they began their life with. That is, when they took office, the first thing they undertook was the building of their tomb. Their life work was reflected in their tomb. Their hope was they wouldn't die before it's finished. The tomb, its preparation, its ceremonies, its symbolism, was their occupation throughout their life. What it isn't obvious unless you really get into the study of the Egyptian background is the absorption of their culture, not just for the pharaohs, the leadership, all the way down. It's a question of scale and it's a question of what they could afford. Preoccupation with death. Where am I headed? Well, turn with me to Romans 1. From time to time, you'll be confronted by the so-called heathen problem. What about the savage that's in the jungle that's never heard the message of Christ? How does he get saved? When you run into that sort of thing, remember Romans 1. And like all of Paul's letters, it's hard to know exactly where to start and when to end, because not just because his sentences run 7 verses long sometimes. It's because of the flow of thought here. But I'm going to arbitrarily start at verse 18. Bear with me. Romans 1, verse 18. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them, for God hath shown it unto them. For the invisible things of Him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even His eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because when they knew God, they glorified Him not as God, neither were thankful, but became vain in their imaginations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools, and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man, and birds, and four-footed beasts, and creeping things. Yea, even dung beetles. Wherefore God also gave them up to uncleanness through the lust of their own hearts, to dishonor their own bodies between themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for a lie, and worshipped and served the creature more than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. You can read the rest of the chapter on your own. It's interesting to me to have experienced Romans 1 on a trip to Egypt. It fascinated me to just suddenly understand that they worship the God of the dead, not the God of the living. Now, what's the significance of all of that? Psalm 135 tells us that we become like the gods we worship. That's pretty provocative. You become like the gods you worship. When I was a young man, very young man, thinking of different professions, a mentor of mine suggested, Chuck, before you go into a profession, meet the people in that profession. Mix with them a little bit. Because you will become like them if you go in that profession. You're going to go into police work? Mix with some policemen. You're going to be an accountant, a lawyer, a doctor, whatever. Mix with them. Get a feeling for what that group of people are like. Because there will be a tendency for you to become like them. It may be very superficial, just in vocabulary, idioms, what have you, or it could be very profound, depending on a lot of other things. The point is, that was just an experiential example that I think we all can sense. But the Scripture tells us, in Psalm 135, happens to be verse 18, that we will become like the gods we worshiped. Do you want to worship the world? Most people do, right? Let me ask you some questions. Is the world preoccupied with itself? You bet. Is the world covetous? Is the world hard? If so, you'll be preoccupied with yourself. You'll tend to become covetous. You'll tend to become hard. Is the world cruel? You'll become cruel. Is the world unforgiving? You'll be unforgiving. You want to worship Baal? You want to worship Moloch? Take a good look at them, because you will become like the gods you worship. Now, what really hit me personally during our brief visit to Egypt was to experience the darkness. If you talk to anybody on our tour, they'll all tell you the same thing. We talked about it later. No one wanted to say it at first when we entered the land. We all felt it when we crossed the border. Now, don't misunderstand me. The Egyptian people themselves are warm, wonderful people. They really are. As a group, you find very few exceptions. They are just warm and interested and helpful and delightful. I'm not talking about the bureaucrats at the border and all that sort of thing. That's another problem. But there's something about that country that when you enter the country, you, if you're spiritually sensitive at all, you feel it the minute you cross the border. But I'd like you in your mind's eye to join me. We're in Cairo. We've spent some time in the Cairo Museum. We've seen the mummies and the pharaohs and the dynasties and the old kingdom and the middle kingdom and the new kingdom and all of that. Now we're going to enter the bus and go out to Saqqara to see some other things. Marvelous buses, by the way, beautiful things. But we, in the buses, we go through Cairo. It's a typical big, relatively up-to-date Middle Eastern city. But as we go to the outskirts, and we start going through the countryside, you start getting a glimpse of the real Egypt. Now, Egypt's 58 million people, one born every 24 seconds. And as you go along the road, you look out there and you see the hovels. Cardboard, corrugated metal, whatever happens to be around as these people live in the dirt. Young mothers with their babies and families somehow trying to survive. Typical of Asia. You've traveled, you've seen poverty. But it's something you're probably not prepared for. As you go down the road, next to the road, typically there's an aqueduct or a river, whatever you want to call it, anywhere from 10 to 20 feet wide. You notice on both sides, it's wide on both sides, not of concrete, but of trash, 3 to 5 feet high, not occasionally, continually, both sides. In fact, your first superficial glimpse, it looks like like a concrete revetment on both sides of an aqueduct. No, no, it's trash. It is sewage. Continually, both sides. The water isn't blue or clear. It's sort of blue-gray with strange colors. It's sewage. Where they're taking the water for their personal use is the same place that the animals are rinsing in, and where the outlets are, and so on. The hygiene is non-existent. But as you go down this road and you see mile after mile of the real Egypt, and you see the poverty. Now, the more you've studied poverty and famine, the madder you get. Because if you've done any homework on this subject, you know that there's no reason for famine. There is no shortage of food in the world. There is the mismanagement of it. You also discover, if you study this perceptively, that most of that is deliberate power brokering. These people are oppressed because of the greed of others. There are the super rich. There are the power brokers. And there's really no reason for these people to be starving. There's no reason for these mothers begging you to take their children. But the hygiene gets to you. As you see where they live. Where do they live? In a dung heap. Scattered all over that country. And you stand back and realize that Psalm 135 applies. For thousands of years, what did they worship? The animals. They worshiped the dung beetle. And it came home to me in depressing clarity that they have experienced the destiny of being like the God they worshiped. Now, the good news is you and I worship the God of the living, not the God of the dead. Let me make a contrast for you to show you. Let's shift now. And turn with me to a passage I think you're probably familiar with, 1 Corinthians chapter 13. I know you've all heard this before, but bear with me. Come in with me on this. 1 Corinthians chapter 13, a classic, of course, where Paul reminds us that though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels and have not love, I am of become as a sounding bronze or a tinkling cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains and have not love, I am nothing. And though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, and have not love, it profiteth me nothing. Love suffereth long and is kind. Love envieth not. Love vaunteth not itself, is not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemly, seeketh not its own, is not easily provoked, thinketh no evil, rejoiceth not in iniquity, but rejoiceth in truth, beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things. Love never fails. And so forth. You know the passage. But we also know that God is love, don't we? Christ is love, right? Let's demonstrate that. Let's read this passage and substitute the name of Christ in the passage. We'll start from the beginning. Let's just pick it up about verse 4. Christ suffereth long and is kind. Christ envieth not. Christ vaunteth not itself, but is not puffed up. Doth not behave itself unseemly. Speaketh not of his own. Is not easily provoked. Thinketh no evil. Rejoices not in iniquity, but in truth. Beareth all things, believeth all things, hopeth all things, endureth all things, Christ never fails, and so on. If you put the name of Christ in this passage, there's no disruption, is there? It flows with the ring of truth, doesn't it? Right? Now, I won't ask you to do this except in the privacy of your home, but put your name in this passage. Pick it up about verse 4. Speaking of Chuck Missler, suffereth long and is kind. Whoops, well, let's just start right there. Chuck envieth not. Are you kidding? I mean, as you read it, it almost becomes humorous, doesn't it? One of the exciting things about the God we worship is that we, if we endure, will become like Him. Now, we may do that in this passage and sort of smile at ourselves at the enormous gap that occurs between our application and applying the Christ to this, using this as a yardstick, right? But the good news is, as you grow in your Christian walk, as you grow in grace and the knowledge of Lord and Savior, what happens to that gap? It gets smaller, doesn't it? You see, we become like the gods we worship. Now, you say, okay, you know, one thing Chuck teaches us is to apply these things. Okay, we've talked a little bit about Egypt. It was a strange experience going from Israel, the God of the living, to Egypt, the God of death, tombs, pyramids, dung beetles, what have you. It was also a shock to consider that this is not just some peripheral culture. This was the centroid of the world. When there was famine in the days of Joseph, where did the world go to get fed? Egypt. It was the breadbasket of the world, and now it's starving. It ruled the world, and now it's on the byroads of a rubbish heap. If you were alive at the time of the Pharaohs, the one thing you were probably certain of is that Egypt would stand forever. The thing that you could probably totally not comprehend was the decline and demise of this great world empire. Right? Let's move on some thousands of years. Suppose you were a Roman centurion. In the days of the Roman Empire. You might have doubts about many things, but the one thing you really knew, that Rome would stand forever. Right? Interesting. Well, we left Egypt and came home to the United States. Now, what I'd like to bring up now is going to be even more difficult. So let me again, at the risk of being a little tedious, share a few personal remarks about my personal frame of reference. My parents were foreign-born, one from Austria, one from Germany. And as I grew up, they were getting their citizenship papers. When your parents are naturalized citizens, being an American means something quite different, much deeper. Very idealistic as a kid, very A lot of things ran deep. Ended up going to the Naval Academy. Spent 4 years there, graduated with distinction. I spent my time on Warden Field every Wednesday afternoon in the parades and the rest. You can't experience 4 years at any of the service academies without something getting in your blood. Took my commission in the Air Force, spent a good part of my executive career in the defense industry. Was chairman of the board of 4 different defense contractors at different times. I'm saying all this to make a point that I am not an America basher. Being an American means a great deal to me. So having said that, don't misunderstand my subsequent remarks. I also have spent the last 25 years as a senior executive in publicly traded companies. I've served on 12 boards, primarily with an expertise in international finance and high technology turnarounds. So I also view the current international and business scene with some level of expertise and also with some level of an absence of blinders. Whatever else may be true, many of the mistakes I've made being provincial or parochial ain't one of them. There are very few mistakes I've missed. I've worked most of them. The toughest thing you will have to do in the coming months is to somehow try to get America, the United States, into perspective. Not easy, because you love this place. You're enmeshed in this place. It's our world. It's our home. It's going to be very hard for us to take one step back and try to put it in perspective. See, we've all grown up with this idiom that the United States is a Christian nation. It was at one time. The United States probably represents the greatest social experiments ever been conducted on the planet Earth. The way this country was founded, the genius of its founders in its checks and balances, in its values, in its goals, and its institutions, without parallel anywhere in the world. But even their craftsmanship was inadequate to sustain the meddling, the diddling, the destruction of these institutions over the later part of the last two centuries. America today is clearly not a Christian nation. That's tough to say, but just take a good hard look. The official religion of this country is secular humanism. If you want to understand secular humanism, I strongly encourage you to track down a copy of Alan Bloom's book, The Closing of the American Mind. It's an interesting book because we're not talking about a moralist. We're not talking about a theologian or a religious writer. We're talking about a guy who spent 30 years at, I think it was University of Chicago, as an educator and tried to summarize his experience on the American campus over the last 3 decades. But he comes to some fascinating observations. He's an incredibly articulate writer with great insights. But he demonstrates the great irony in academia, this country. How the goal, prior to three decades ago, the goal of a classic education was to understand the great minds of the past because they presumably would give some illumination to dealing with the problems of the future. That was sort of the concept of a classical education, is to learn the best of the past to prepare yourself to enjoy the future. But somehow, some 2 or 3 decades ago, what emerged in the campus was the goal of being open, not being myopic. Let's not impute our value system on others. And after all values are relative. What emerged in the American consciousness was this concept of value relativism. Well, the great irony that occurred, of course, is that if all values are equal or equally valid, so to speak, then if that's the case, what is not obvious until you think about it is if that's what you really believe, then history holds no clues to the future. And the modern graduate from college does not have a rapport, an intimacy, if you will, to the great thinkers as they used to have. They're, after all, just another set of values. And what's interesting is that the American graduate, in the words of Bloom, has a closed mind to the past and thus is totally ill-equipped to even understand the issues forthcoming. But the main point that Bloom brings out is that without absolutes a society becomes morally bankrupt. And I think that's a fascinating conclusion for a secular writer. You and I may nod in agreement very quickly because we have the benefit of a biblical background. I'm separating that. Just from an intellectual point of view, Bloom develops the essentialness of absolutes. But see, from secular humanism, what's the next step? Paganism. This country, obviously, conspicuously, is moving to paganism. That's the next step. Now, it comes under many fancy trappings, the New Age being one of them. Another little assignment, informal assignment I'll give you, when you get it, if you haven't done this yet, I encourage you to get an opportunity to borrow one of the Jeremiah Films episodes on the pagan invasion. There's 13 of them, but they will dramatize for you in video form the various costumes that paganism wears as it tramples through our culture. Let me give you some subtle examples. I'm not against animal rights. I'm not a tree hugger myself. But the animal rights people are obviously a militant group. But isn't it interesting? Think through the implications when the animal rights are put ahead of human rights. Is that any different than going through India or Egypt and seeing it perhaps in more primitive forms? If I'm correct in this overview, then it's my premise that what we saw happen to Egypt, which went from a world empire to the rubbish heap, is going to happen to the United States. Not in the same form, because we worship slightly different gods, but we will become like the gods we worship. And let's take a good look at what's happening to the United States. Let's start at the top. I'm going to suggest that we have a moral decline in the United States, and my first evidence to put before the bar is the cast of characters that are running for public office. You know, I stand back and look at the Soviet Union. Whatever faults it has, I have to be impressed that they brought forth Gorbachev as a leader. Now, whatever he is, sincere and sincere, that's not my point. He's a class act. Sharp guy, competent, effective. Now, he had a slippery rock to stand on, no question about it. You can look around other places and find interesting guys. You'll take a look at our cast of characters, and you wouldn't hire them to clean your garage. Someone told a congressman to fly a kite, and he misunderstood, huh? 355 kited checks. You know, it's interesting how... It's interesting to see how the American voter is now finally angry. He's angry for the wrong reasons, probably, but at least he's angry. For the first time in recent history, it's a liability to be an incumbent. And boy, that's at least progress. I used to go back to Washington. I was on the board of the Computer Industry Association. And I used to go back to Washington just to have a little stick, to do something a little different. We always used to mix with the Congress and the Senate at the receptions. And I always used to carry some badges just to stir up trouble. When Carter was in office, I was a little upset with our export policy. So I had large badges made and it said, "Eat imported peanuts." And so, in a subsequent year, I sort of had to keep the badge thing going because everybody kidded. You know, "What's Chuck Mister going to bring back this year?" I used to always carry a bunch in my pocket. And the receptions, you know, you pass them out because, "Okay, can I get one of those?" You know, first thing you know, I had everybody wearing it, would stir up. It was just a way of being colorful, I guess. The next year, though, I was just bitter, so I had badges made up: "Re-elect nobody." I'm rummaging through my garage to see if I can still find one of those. I may make them up again because I think I can probably raise some money for my ministry by just selling those for a buck a piece. I think I'd do. You know, I grew up as a kid viewing the U.S. Senate as the highest office in the land. Not the president. The president was a hireling. He was only elected for 4. Congressman, 2 years, they're lightweights. The president, 4 years, okay, he's the administrator. But the guy that was really the pro, the guy that was aloof from the day-to-day baloney, was a senator. I mean, I really had that mentality. And for a while there, they carried that aegis. You know, the Senate was somehow something apart. All of that went down the drain for me during the Iran-Contra hearings. You see, I've spent enough time in the intelligence community to understand how... much effort we put to trying to find out how our adversaries make decisions. The most priceless information you get your hands on is insights as to how the inner counsels work. That's what you need to know about your adversary. And to have the senators on public television lay out the inner workings of the National Security Council, as far as I'm concerned, borders on treason. These guys are willing to hold the security interests of the United States hostage to their own egos. What they did to Ollie North is inexcusable, but if they're going to do it at all, they should have done it behind closed doors, not where all of that gets out in the open. That's when I begin. Can you imagine yourself having been recruited for Foreign Service and being on station in a covert assignment and discovering that your bosses can't or won't cover you? Imagine yourself if you had the job of recruiting for those replacements today. No one in their right mind would take that on that kind of assignment with the irresponsibility that went all the way up to the chief executive office. Why Reagan, after Bush was elected, when he was lame duck, didn't pardon Ollie North to spare his family that grief and suffering is inexcusable. My respect for the man personally evaporated. I would have thought one day, up to the election, fine, it's an issue. Once the election, he could have signed a pardon and put the whole thing to bed. But he didn't, which tells you where their egos are. And I regard all of that in disgust. By the way, before I get too heavy here, do you know the difference between Ted Kennedy and the Iraqi Air Force? Only one of them has a confirmed kill. Ooh, that's bad, yeah. What's the conclusion? I believe that the United States is ripe for judgment. I felt this way before the trip because I could just see it as an industrialist, as a practicing executive, that is at the moment one notch away to really get a perspective, and I really see that all happening. But after seeing Egypt and realizing God's hand in these things, it's also obvious that the United States is ripe for judgment. We have failed to keep faith with the God that blessed this land in the first place. That's why we have 36,000 new VD cases every day, according to the Atlanta Disease Control. You can look around the horizon, find almost any indicator you want, and we got deep, deep troubles. Now, most of us have gathered here on these evenings, and we've talked prophecy. And as we survey the world scene, we also see that this particular scenario I'm suggesting is not inconsistent with what we understand to be the prophetic scenario. As we look around the world, we know that, Israel's in the land, Israel's in control of Jerusalem, and incidentally, they're starting to build their temple. We'll talk more about that the next evening in detail. We also know that Magog is ready to invade the Middle East. Hal Lindsey and I are just finishing up a report called The Magog Factor. It's basically unusually well-documented work highlighting just who is Magog in Ezekiel 38. And clearly, Magog is the ancestor to the Scythians. The Scythians are kind of interesting people. They were legendary horsemen and archers. One of their definitive skills was to be able to bring down a bird in flight, even shooting behind them while at a full gallop. And that skill made them legend in the old world. They're the ones that invented trousers because it was easy to ride horseback with. They used to carry about 200-300 arrows in a quiver. They could hawk about 10-1 in speed against their enemies. They used to drink the blood of their enemies out of their guy's skull and use the skin to decorate their quivers. These were rough dudes. It's interesting, some of the archaeologists are puzzled why they can't find more graves. I don't know why it hasn't occurred to them. They're obviously cannibalistic. But the interesting thing is they, of course, are the ancestors to the true Russian, ethnologically. That's Magog. And Ezekiel talks about Magog and how it's going to get sucked in. It's going to get hooks in the jaw and drawn in to an invasion in Israel. And the five southern Muslim republics, as we reported to you before, are right on cue. The world as we see it today is more dangerous today than ever. It fascinates me to watch the nonsense in the paper and the rhetoric in Washington, our so-called peace dividend. What nonsense. We had stability in the planet Earth because we had two players, equally balanced, both rational. That's out the window. How many third world countries are building ICBMs today? Answer, 22. How many of those have nuclear capability? Answer, 11. Are they in balance? No. They're all mad at each other, let alone united by Islam, a major chunk of them, united by Islam to destroy Israel. It's interesting, a major section of them march to an agenda you and I would consider irrational. How do you have a chicken race with someone who believes he goes to heaven if he loses? You know, it's all ready to happen. And, of course, the Bible says, well, all this is going on, there's going to be a super state emerging in Europe that'll emerge to be a global empire, and we're watching that unfold week by week.